one way to think about conservatism is that it is, among many things, perhaps above all, the task and duty of remembering. A task and a practice that's made difficult today because ours is a purposefully amnesic society. A civilization that literally today seeks to shatter every monument to the past in the name of a supposedly utopian future. But the task of remembering has also been challenged by another unlikely source. It is from the conservatism that arose and became a powerful political force over the past 50 or so years. As Yoram pointed out in his brilliant remarks this morning, the conservative movement of the past generation has crafted a very well-burnished portrait of America as inherently and as fundamentally the land of individual freedom, what he called public liberalism. The depiction of America from the very outset is told as a tale of an ever more perfected but still more perfectible realm of individual liberty, especially in the domain of economic life and social life. Economic life more for conservatives, social life more for progressive liberals. A generation of Americans, conservative and liberal, have grown up believing that America is above all a liberal project of individual autonomy since its very outset, one that has become more perfected with every passing year. Both sides of liberalism, classical and progressive, have invested incalculable amounts of money and effort in promoting what is essentially an invented tradition that America was at the very outset this purely liberal nation. It was promised to us that an ethos of live and let live would usher in a society of peace and prosperity. But in fact, look around you, as my friend Sohrab Ahmari likes to say. We have in fact witnessed the exact opposite, a society that is increasingly divided between have and have nots of all races, and one that is riven by a deepening division marked by growing violence, especially because of the growing class and cultural divide that defines this country. Notice what these two projects, these two twin projects of left and right liberalism have brought us. The libertarian economic vision, which tells us that it's a matter of indifference where and how products are produced, as long as consumers are satisfied with cheap products, has brought us a half century of economic globalization, open borders, the outsourcing of jobs and manufacturing, and a growing dependence on foreign products for a basic survival. And of late, we've noticed the lengthening supply lines that can be ground to a halt with a grain of sand thrown into their complex works. Meanwhile, the libertarian social and sexual vision of the progressives has ushered in the purported unencumbered human person by supporting divorce, abortion, childlessness, by denigrating motherhood and marriage, certainly a marriage between a man and a woman at least, and most recently, denying the fundamental, complementary, and beautiful differences between men and women. Because of these liberations from each other, a promotion of a mutual indifference, we are touted as having achieved the realization of the American creed of freedom. Instead, these twin projects have ushered in devastation for a large number of our countrymen. And notice how both of these projects have been especially costly in one part of the country and among one class of our country. The realization of a society of mutual indifference about economic decisions and about sexual arrangements has resulted in massive and incalculable, is the result, sorry, of a massive and incalculable investment by institutions of the right and the left, on the right think tanks, programming and in internships that steep the next generation in the creed of American liberalism, and on the left, the university, the foundations, media, Hollywood, all mutually educating a generation on the nature of the American liberal regime. The upshot of this investment should now be clear to us. It has gone toward the creation and the maintenance of an oligarchic class who have mutually benefited from the decimation of the working class of all races in this country and of all geographic regions of this country. The full flowering of the reality of this ideology reveals it to be an ideology of rapine and plunder, the stripping of the wealth from a ship that they are sinking while busily stocking the lifeboats until the last moment when they will be able to cut loose. As the young people like to say, it's time to take the red pill. We must see this jointly created, invented tradition of America as a fundamentally or solely liberal nation as a recent innovation that is, in fact, a departure from the actual American tradition. It is an invented tradition that has been launched in the service of a rapacious ruling class, which is benefiting from its rewards. As conservatives, we are charged with remembering the past, even as we build a future that draws from a genuinely American tradition. This nation was not founded to liberate us from each other, to make us mutually indifferent, and to put us on the path of a national self-immolation, but to preserve a number of pre-liberal legacies of practices and of beliefs, especially as Yoram was emphasizing, a very public Christian religion that were once widespread. Both the libertarian economic philosophy and social progressivism were in fact born and developed several centuries after the founding of this nation and grafted in an artificial way onto our tradition by claiming their basis in the Constitution, whether through a contrived liberal originalism or a self-serving progressivism. But neither reflects the original purpose of the American project. Note that from the very beginning, America was not libertarian in either the economic or the social spheres. This was an uncontroversial fact since before and during and long after our founding. And it is a fact enshrined in the Constitution, if we properly understand it, that both spheres were to be governed by considerations and actions on behalf of the common good. The Constitution established a division of labor toward this end, a federalism that showed cognizance of the wisdom of subsidiarity. The nation was to be charged, the nation, the entire political, the large political order, the whole political order, was to be charged especially with the governance of the economic sphere, while the states and the localities were charged with the promotion of the common good, especially in the social sphere, especially through police powers, the powers to legislate morality. Yet while these spheres of focus were to call for distinct kinds of legislation and oversight, in the view of the founding generation, they were deeply connected. Only a virtuous citizenry, after all, could ultimately ensure a moral economic order. In the first place, by teaching citizens how to seek out and recognize the qualities of excellence and virtue for those who they would select for national office. Those who would work for an economy not only to generate a high GDP, but an economy that would serve the common good and ultimately be subordinate to the political authority of the nation. In turn, only a moral economic order could reinforce the social and civic virtues of the citizenry, providing widespread prosperity and security in equal measure. So a virtuous cycle between the different parts of our political order was envisioned. The founding generation and subsequent generations, until very recent times, understood this deep and underlying connection and the reinforcement, the mutual reinforcement of these spheres. The national sphere was to be charged, above all, with three main tasks to promote three distinct ends. First, to promote prosperity. It was charged with the creation of a national system, as it was once called. The creation of a national infrastructure, the roads, canals, communication networks, eventually airlines, as well as the standardization of various measures, time zones, other standards that would be useful for commercial and intellectual exchange, the recognition of patents and the protection of inventions. The Interstate Commerce Clause was then, as well as now, conceived as a powerful tool, as were the general clauses of the Constitution to promote the useful arts and sciences, as was charged by Congress, to Congress, and of course in the preamble to promote the general welfare. Second, there was a widespread agreement that the economic order should support national security and promote both national and personal independence. Strong domestic manufacturing, agriculture, and intellectual spheres of life were to be promoted especially to avoid undue reliance on foreign production and manufacturing, and to foster economic independence among citizens, which was understood to be constitutive of the genuine condition of freedom. Now, while Hamilton and Jefferson famously disagreed on what they envisioned would be the economic form of the United States, they actually agreed deeply in the belief that an economic order must be ordered to a form of political and personal independence. Hamilton stressed the importance of national independence through manufacture and the protection with tariffs and limits on the importation of foreign products, while Jefferson advanced a vision of yeoman farmers who would be free of the petty tyranny of employers and the precarious condition of wage earners. But both agreed that economic independence was a common good that ought to be promoted through our politics. And third, the national government was understood to be fierce in preventing and dismantling economic monopolies, that inherent feature of a commercial and market system in which firms seek to eliminate competition and corner a market. This tendency of firms within a market economy was understood to be destructive of the common good, as destructive as potentially a political tyrant. A national government was to be both vigilant and powerful enough to govern and control such large actors in the private sphere. Meanwhile, it was largely left to the purview of the states and localities to foster social and civic virtue. This was readily evident to Alexis de Tocqueville when he came to the United States in the 1830s, a half century after ratification, who didn't only just notice the importance of private associations or semi-private associations, but stressed how central civic and political life was at the local level. It wasn't just about voluntary associations, it was our civic life, our shared civic life. This runs against some of the embrace, especially as Yoram was describing, of a kind of private conservatism. It was a very public form of civic self-governance. And until fairly recently, such local governing institutions were charged explicitly with legislating morality, which was a far more constitutive part of the American tradition than one would recognize if one were only taught the invented tradition by the liberal ruling class. The states were charged especially to foster virtue in three different spheres. First, to promote the formation of families, the marriage of men and women, and the encouragement to have and to protect children that would issue from such marriages. There were laws against adultery and fornication, which were intended to discourage straying from the bonds of sacred matrimony and to prevent the creation of children outside of wedlock. Laws presumptively against divorce were universal, making it rare and socially shameful. Localities and later states supported the creation of public schools that was intended to reinforce rather than undermine the kinds of values that were enshrined in these laws and taught in homes. The family was the basic unit of society, and the public order expressed its commitment to fostering familial stability and the formation of the next generation. Second, local police powers of states and localities were intended to ensure a decent civic and public order. Laws against obscenity, pornography, were common until recent times. Some of a certain age can perhaps still remember that there existed national laws and regulations that mandated family programs during certain times of the day. This was 8 to 10 o'clock at night on television. Hard to believe. Some of you old enough will also remember it was Tipper Gore, yes, the wife of Al Gore, who encouraged and pushed for warning labels on albums. Now, you young people don't know what these are. These were ways of conveying music once upon a time, which would help parents to decide whether albums were appropriate to be brought into the home, whether they contained obscene lyrics. A legal emphasis upon decorum supported and cultivated a society in which decorum was also a social norm. Look at pictures or old videos of how people used to dress compared to how they dress today. Even the protesters in the 60s wore jackets and ties. You know, it's amazing, those radical young people out in Berkeley, California. Lastly, the police powers emphasized the central importance of religion in a healthy society. At the time of the American founding, and for much of its history, until very recent times, late the latter part of the 20th century, the First Amendment was adopted and understood not to separate church and state, which is a fiction of the invented tradition of American liberalism, but to prevent the national government from interfering in the religious establishment and advancement of religion in their particular localities or their states. In fact, at the time, to protect religious establishments that existed in many states at the time of the American founding. That's why Congress was barred from establishing a religion, because there were state establishments of religion. We tend to forget, we think the First Amendment is about secularization. No, the First Amendment was about protecting religion in the various states and localities. Many state constitutions positively mandated a duty to believe in God as a civic and human duty. Many mandated laws against blasphemy and required observations of the Sabbath. I grew up in Connecticut at a time when there were still things called blue laws, believe it or not. These kinds of mandates on behalf of the common good were common, frequent, and a deep and inherent part of the American tradition. Theory has ignored reality. This is the opposite of conservatism. But this theory of America as a liberal nation has had very profound and real-world effects, as Yoram this morning, I think, brilliantly elucidated, seemingly pitting right liberals against left liberals, but always advancing liberalism in both spheres of life, corroding every existing social norm and eroding any support for the existence of a common good. Today, it's just as likely that anyone promoting the common good will be attacked instantly and immediately, probably on Twitter, by liberal conservatives as well as progressives. The vested interest in maintaining a corrosive political order are powerful and pervasive. And note who is benefiting from these set of arrangements. There's a lot of money to be made in the decline of America. To restore the genuine American common good and national conservative tradition, we must creatively pursue these same ends, albeit today through different means. This means revisiting and, where necessary, revising the original division of labor, recognizing the historic role of locality and states, but also recognizing they may no longer be sufficient or equal to the task in an age in which we have titanic and towering concentrations, especially of private economic power. Look what happened to my state of Indiana when it tried to pass a RFRA law. We were threatened with economic destruction by the likes of Amazon and Apple and Salesforce and the NCAA. This was from a set of organizations that were devoted to overturning the legitimate passage of a state democratic law. The founding generation understood that only a well-formed and virtuous citizenry would be capable of identifying and selecting public servants who would act on behalf of the common good. To revive this possibility of a virtuous circle, certain authoritative acts will need to be taken, considered, and advanced at the national as well as the state and local levels, in part to restore the prospect for more local political institutions to take on their original role. A constitutive feature of conservatism is a deep realism about the art of the possible. We can never simply return, even if they are eternal truths. We can only and must go forward from where we find ourselves today. The restoration of a common good tradition in America will require a new American revolution. Like our first revolution, we should aim to oust the entrenched oligarchy that has now taken advantage of many of its fellow citizens and put in their place the kind of political leaders supported by the kinds of citizens who, like our forebears, fought and founded a nation in which any liberty worthy of possessing must be advanced by and for a truly common good. Thank you.